Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
I'm opening.
We have
an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Welcome back, everybody, back to Popcorn Talk Network's Anatomy of a Movie show. Today, we are doing Kung Fu Panda 3.
Yes!
Very, very exciting. The third installment of the Kung Fu Panda franchise. I'm your host, Marissa Serafini. And joining me, I have...
Hi, I'm Frank Moran. Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at HappyGoJackie.
There you go. Frank, and this is your first time being on an animated movie, so welcome.
Thank you for having me. Looking forward to it. Always like to talk a nice animated movie.
Oh, don't even get me started on animated, but we actually are going to start. So Kung Fu Panda 3, the third one. Were you a fan of this now franchise, now trilogy of Kung Fu Panda beforehand, and what were your quick overall thoughts of this film?
I guess when you think animated films, you think like Pixar and things like that, and I guess my preferences probably lead more towards that style. So when like Shrek, was never a fan of like the DreamWorks, some of the stuff that they were putting out, but with the Kung Fu Panda franchise, and as well as How to Train Your Dragon, those are the two franchises for me that really kind of started turning my attention towards DreamWorks and stuff that they're trying to accomplish in their films. So I've been enjoying the first two films, and I was looking forward to seeing where they're going to take the character in this one. And I felt like there were some really nice logical steps with the character and progression they made. So I did enjoy where they went in this third film.
Absolutely. I remember when the first Kung Fu Panda came out, and I was like, pandas, you got me.
Yeah.
And animation. So I was glad that the gang's all back and, you know, have Po and his friends. And I was really looking forward to it because... From the first two films, they generated like $1.3 billion. They were humongous hits, especially here in America and in China, because, you know, it speaks to the Chinese demographic as well. And so we knew, like, Kung Fu Panda is going to be, like, awesome. And the third film was going to be, like, even bigger than most.
Yeah, I mean, and the idea that they announced that they're, at least the idea back in 2010, that they could envision this being, like, a six-part series. So
six parts.
Although, as we'll talk about this film, where they bring the character to the end at the end of this film, I'm like, is there room for a fourth? I'm not sure.
Oh, I mean, we'll get to that. Yes. And like getting more so then, so if this generates more sequels. But also coming back, we had the director. We had Jennifer Yu, who directed the second film, but she was also the head of story of the first film too. So she's always been part of the Kung Fu Panda series. And then we also had co-director Alessandro Carloni, who also co-directed the second film. So, like, they have a working relationship. And the interesting thing I found out about this film was that it was purposely animated to be both in English and Mandarin.
I thought that was really cool. The fact that they would, because you'd think, like, all right, well, we're just going to dub it over in Mandarin, and that's fine. But that they actually took the time to match the animation with the Mandarin actor's dialogue, I thought shows you how important the Chinese market is for this film.
And, you know, because also Chinese and that demographic just helped with the financial and the storytelling of these films. You have to cater to that type of audience as well. Maybe I shouldn't say cater, but you have to, you know, also please them.
Yeah.
Because they're going to eat it up too, just like us Americans.
Absolutely.
And anyone else in the world that is watching this film. It really shows the testament how much they love and how much effort they put into this film.
Yeah, and the way, with them being so heavily involved, then it doesn't worry about them getting less money if it's an imported film to the Chinese market. Since they have such an ownership inside the film, they get a bigger percentage of the profits on the Chinese side as well. So it works out for them as well.
Yeah, and the fun thing is, for the directors, Jennifer and Alessandro, they said for the first two, they didn't have a lot of references to go off of to, you know, create these stories and the characters. And so they didn't have as many resources to, you know, pull from while developing. But this time around, they had access to hundreds of Chinese artists who politely informed them if something went wrong.
Yeah, that's what I think.
I And for example, if you don't understand, is that if there was a wardrobe, a certain type of wardrobe on a character that was fashion faux pas, in the Chinese culture, that they would tell them, it's like, no, you can't do that. Or there's like, or it'd be, say, the wrong wardrobe would represent the wrong Chinese dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I didn't even think about that. No. I thought, I was like, oh, yeah, that looks cool. You know, but, like, the details that they put into just the wardrobe and the culture aspects of everything. Did you find that interesting, or did you notice anything that would be like, wow, I didn't know that about the Chinese culture?
I've always enjoyed the character designs that they've done in these films. Admittedly, my knowledge of Chinese culture or fashion mm-hmm. is not as in-depth to know if anything would be a faux pas for that. I've only just appreciated it for the aesthetic that I've seen. But knowing that they had Chinese artists working on this one, kind of almost like fact-checking them to make sure, like, all right, this may look really cool, but is not really culturally appropriate to what is really interesting for them to kind of balance that out with the story.
Yeah, and I found another fun example was that we always see Po, the main character. He eats a lot. And in Chinese culture, it's actually you don't leave your chopsticks in a bowl. And apparently there were some shots, animation shots, where there was chopsticks were left in the bowl. And they're like, uh-uh, you can't do that. That's a big no-no. Something as simple as leaving chopsticks in a bowl. So I found that interesting. So, you know, just the depths of just catering to both demographics was really, you know, really, really shocking. What I've found, let's talk about the writing.
Sure.
Because we had all these characters, they have come back and then they also bring in a new villain as well. Did you enjoy the characters, assuming that you've seen the first two films?
Yes.
Did you enjoy the characters and what they brought to this particular storyline? They're all in peril in a way,
well,
again.
I guess I feel like, in the first one, I felt that was your one chance because you were introducing Poe into this larger world. I mean, he's always had a dream of, being a kung fu master, or just the idea of being able to do all this. And you find Crane and Mantis and Tigress and all them, and you learn about them. So I feel like you learn a lot about them in that first film. But I feel like in the subsequent films, the focus has been more on Poe since I guess this is his journey.
Yeah.
So they have not had as much to do, I feel, in the other two films. And I felt like the same thing for this one. They were just kind of like there, but not really that instrumental to the plot.
You know what? I thought that too. And it might be a testament to the writing because they gave Poe such a strong storyline with now introducing his father, which they hinted at in the second film, like his mother, his biological mother and father, which we only saw the father in the third film. But
yeah.
they did hint at, you know, Poe's biological family. And I think taking that big storyline, they only really focused on that, and we had the characters just there. It's like it's set up that, oh, Poe has to save his friends. But it was still about Poe, not about the friends.
Yeah, and just seeing what the authors were saying in an interview, it's that when they wrote that last line at the end of the second film, where they say, "Oh, my son is alive," they feel like, "Oh man!" In retrospect, perhaps we kind of pigeonholed ourselves. If we would have just had him say Poe is alive, we wouldn't have had to worry about him being his father. We could have left that open. But since we said that, that's mm-hmm. basically if we've got to follow up on that, and that's kind of like the starting point where we got to start fleshing out the third movie. We've got to work with that we've kind of, those kind of things that we've hamstrung ourselves with at the end of the second film.
Yeah, and what was also interesting is that the directors, having come in off of the second film, they actually took a 6-month break from, you know, writing, and because, you know, they set up the potential of having a father-son relationship, and now knowing that, they're like, we really have to write a very strong storyline for us to even come back for a third one. That's one that's worth telling.
Yeah, absolutely, because even them saying, with the original idea, like, oh, this could be a 6-part series, that even the directors and the writers saying, we're just addressing them just one at a time at this point. That we got to make sure everything is perfect as it is and not going to worry about, like, oh, we're trying to set up some long kind of franchise. Because if the story you're not telling right now isn't really strong and complete and whole, then what's the point of worrying about 4, 5, and 6?
Yeah. What I also enjoyed is that they... Because for the first and second films, there was more so like one villain, one big main antagonist that they had to fight up against. And granted, the first one, they were establishing characters, establishing a villain. Second one, the characters are already established, but now just another new villain. But this one, what I liked about this, the third antagonist, was that it was set in a different world. So now you're not just grounded, you're literally in a spiritual realm where, like, gravity doesn't affect you. Like, the laws of physics are kind of, like, out the window. And I liked how that works for animation because, you know, they just throw your imagination out there.
Yeah, and if you look at the first film, I mean, our villain is more just, you know, just a fighter, just, you know, just pure fighter. Shen in the second film, it's all about technology, using the fireworks and things like that. And then this one, they got it, as Guillermo del Toro was saying, we've got to really raise the stakes. And how what better way to raise that is by taking it into the spirit realm, introducing the supernatural elements into this franchise.
Yeah, and it's great you mentioned Guillermo del Toro because he also added to this film and consulted here and there. And it was his idea to have the Jade Warriors.
And I thought that was a really cool look for that, to take what was just a little piece of Chinese culture and then turning it into a way to have the villain be able to kind of drive the story, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, and also, you know, just doing the research after the fact and after this, I found it very fascinating because the Jades, I believe, they're usually hung on a belt. And for Kai, the main antagonist in this film, he hung it around his neck. And it was on some bills, but there was a moment it was, like, around his neck as well.
Which I feel like, I mean, because that's a Ugoi, so I feel like he's the big prize. So I feel like it's all right, he's going to be on the neck. Yeah, he's the big Ugoi. Fish. Yeah, or big turtle. Big shell.
Okay, so let's talk about the characters. Obviously, Poe is back. We have Jack Black. What did you think of Jack Black and just what he added to this character and, like, his voice, everything.
Well, when you bring Jack Black into a project, one thing for sure, you're going to get a lot of energy and enthusiasm. I feel like, certainly with this role, I mean, it seems like a very a nice match of talent and character, because you feel like you can just see a lot of Jack Black in there, just kind of the high energy that he brings to the roles. And but he's able to do those just kind of nice little grounded moments, too, because it's all about Poe, especially in this third film, pushing out of his traditional comfort zone. He is somebody that achieved his dream, and now is just kind of like living, I've accomplished everything. But no. You can't be content with where you are. You got to keep pushing yourself. And I felt like he was able to touch on some of those more quieter moments.
Absolutely. And we know Jack. I personally know Jack Black as an actor for, you know, bringing the comedic timing to certain situations. And then, like, I don't really know him from his drama. Like, I'm saying I know him personally, but, like, the way that I see him as an actor, I see Jack Black, I think, a comedy. And so I know he can bring that funny aspect to this type of character. And, you know, having the first two, the audience already got a sense of who Poe was. He's just, like, the everyday lovable guy who, in a way, you know, he overcomes, he's put into, he learns the discipline of Kung Fu. And then everyone just loves him, no matter what. Even if he messes up, people still love him at the end of the day. And I think that's what Jack Black does in all of his characters. Like, he's hard to hate, you know? He's not a character, you know, to dislike. I was watching a lot of behind-the-scenes videos of Jack Black recording the lines, and he is the most hysterical guy in the booth. He's like, he gets physically animated. He really gets into his character, like karate chop, and he'll like actually physically do the motion. So like, he really gets into it and gives it his all.
Yeah, well, and I mean, that plays so well into Poe's character, because he's somebody that just loves everything about being a dragon warrior. So I mean, just every time they're just jumping around the city, even just to go get food, like at the beginning of the film, it's got to end with a cool pose. It's got to be with the cool pose.
Yeah. I really enjoyed that because what was the takeout delivery?
Yes, they're going for justice.
Yeah, justice. Delivery of justice. Right? That was hysterical. Again, so just showing like the friends are together. You think they're fighting, but no, they're getting food.
No, that's it. There you go.
But they're still fighting at the end of the day. And then we had the introduction, of course, of Lee, who is Poe's biological father, voiced by Bryan Cranston.
Yeah, it was, and admittedly, I didn't go in knowing all the voice actors going ahead, the new additions to the storyline. As I was listening to the movie, I was like, who is that voice? I was trying to nab it. And then at the end, I was like, oh, it's Bryan Cranston. Like, Bryan Cranston, why didn't I have that? But I just a very versatile actor and a vocal performer. So I thought he fit really well in with Jack Black in terms of just their energy. And it was just seeing, you could definitely see, at least through his performance, where Poe came from. You could see even though he hadn't been raised to him, by him, that you could see just a lot of influence. Like, yep, you could definitely see that this is Poe's father.
Yeah. You see the physical genetics, some of the lazy traits of a panda that is like, okay, I see where Poe gets it.
Or even just the sense of play.
The playfulness of Poe. Everyone enjoys Brian Cranston. I've never seen him something where I didn't like him. I like the directors mentioned because when they were casting for Poe's father's voice of Lee, they said they wanted a 45-year-old character who never had the discipline of Kung Fu, but can also be lovable in that way. So, like, a fun guy who is also lazy, more so. And they said Bryan Cranston just really brought great comedic timing to his lines, and that he's the believable father figure.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I guess we all know him as probably most recently as Walter White. But I mean, everybody knows before Breaking Bad. Malcolm in the Middle. So it always seems like the pendulum always swings both ways for him, because just when Breaking Bad starts, they're like, oh, this is a dad from Malcolm in the Middle. What's going on? This seems so weird. But now he's been so associated as Walter White in Breaking Bad that everybody was like, he did do comedy before this guy, so this is not out of his wheelhouse.
See, I knew him before Breaking Bad in comedy, and in fairness, I haven't watched Breaking Bad, so I really don't know his dramatic side. Shifu, Dustin Hoffman.
How can you go wrong with Dustin Hoffman?
And I believe this was one of Dustin Hoffman's first recurring roles, because he usually does movies and there's really no sequels to him.
Yeah, so it's interesting to see. What's nice about not just Dustin, but there are the rest of the cast, Angelina Jolie, Seth Rogen, David Cross, Jackie Chan, they're all coming back. They're all coming back for all these, which is really cool. I always like Shifu again. Always wanted to accomplish something for himself as well, which is always kind of pretty much related to what Poe's sense of journey and discovery is going to be at the film. So I feel like, Shifu's always on this long journey to try to accomplish this thing, and then always eternally frustrated because Poe can usually master within the course of the film.
Yeah, usually. What did you think of the storyline that they gave Shifu, now pretty much passing the torch onto Poe, like making him the kung fu teacher now, and everyone has to obey his commands?
I love that, because I mean, it was for two reasons. I mean, one, Shifu wanted to take the time to learn to be a master of chi. But then also, as we just talked about a little bit before, it's just like realizing that Poe had just really become just very comfortable where he was, and he wasn't looking to push himself and become bigger than what he was and accomplish more than what he's and realize his full potential. And so I thought Shifu was really good and instrumental in kind of setting him on that path, like, no, you are more than what you are, and I'm going to help you become the best possible you can be.
Yeah, and I love that. I love character development when other people push people to do more than what they think that they can do. And one of the best lines Shifu had in the film was like, if you can only do what you can do, you'll never be more than you are now. And I think that goes for every culture and just human, existence in and of itself. I think it's like, if you're complacent in life and you don't do more, then you'll never be more.
Yeah, when he also says, too, it's like when Poe says, well, I can't be you. And he says, I don't want you to be me. I'm going to help you be you. Mm-hmm. So I like that idea where it's like, we're not trying to mold you into somebody else. Just take whoever you are and just be the best possible version of that.
Yeah, I think Shifu, he's very philosophical, but he's a great teacher. Like, people can learn from him.
Yeah.
Even if he is an animated character, like, he has a lot of great things to say.
Yeah, and I feel like that this is a really good story point for Poe to be on right now, because he's such an insecure character throughout the other two films. Just, he's always battling some sort of insecurities as well. Mm-hmm. And this one, finally, the idea of, like, putting him in the role of a teacher. And the teacher is such an enormous responsibility, because I think for many people, you have to come to that point in your life where you feel you have something of yourself to impart to others. And for somebody that is kind of an insecure character to feel like, am I ready to take on such a responsibility to pass? Am I worthy enough to pass on anything to anybody else?
Yeah. And I loved his dramatic exit. That was amazing.
Yes.
Oh, look. What's that? Great. So I think all these characters had, like, great, just comedic timing. But, of course, we had Seth Rogen back as Mantis.
There you go. You can't go wrong with him.
Fun Mantis. Kate Hudson, who played Mei Mei. She was the female panda bear who was ribbon twirling.
Yeah, and I like that. I mean,
this was a nice, surprising character.
Definitely. And I know that they originally cast it with Rebel Wilson.
And then they changed it.
Yes, and they even went back and reanimated some of the sequences to match more of what Kate Hudson was doing with the character. So I thought that was really cool. But yeah, I was intrigued at first, like, oh, is this going to be a potential Poe romance? Mm-hmm. But I did like that they didn't go down that road. But they just let her just kind of just be this really eccentric character.
I love that, too, because it is the first female. We're led to believe that that's the first female panda that Poe has ever crossed. And the directors even said that they set it up so people can think that there's going to be a love interest involved, but then it wouldn't let Mei Mei be herself. It would be Mei Mei and Poe. And like, she wouldn't be able to build her own character if Poe was always part of it. And part of her storyline. So I really enjoyed the fact that they didn't take it there.
Yes, definitely. It was just a nice subversion of what, I guess you would have the expectations of that particular scene. Especially that first scene where he does see her and you see his eyes just kind of widen and everything and you think like, oh, he's falling in love. Like, no, he's not falling in love. He's just like, well, this is really cool.
There's another woman panda. Yeah. He doesn't know what to do with himself. I really liked Mei. She was just so quirky, and there was a diva-esque aspect of her.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's what they, the directors described Mei as, like a Broadway diva.
Yeah, and she definitely plays into that, just the fanfare that she brings for herself. She comes in and she does her ribbon twirling right there.
Yeah, and I think Kate Hudson's great. I mean, she's fantastic, and she's a great dancer and singer herself. Lucy Liu, also back as Viper.
I feel like out of the five for this film, I felt like I saw the least of her in this one.
Yeah. Pushed to the wayside.
Yes. I'm like, well, all right.
Yeah, I think so too. Unfortunately, it was like Viper, Crane, and Monkey were really, because of their unfortunate situation being put in Jade, you know, the Jade Crystals and whatnot, that they really didn't get a storyline.
No, that was
they were taken out really early in the story.
Yeah, I mean, and I'd at least give it up for Crane and Mantis, at least having a little extra scene by themselves to go and do something.
Mm-hmm.
But poor Viper, nothing.
They were gone within the first 30 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, no.
And then they didn't come back till the end. I was like, so we had David Cross as Crane, and then Jackie Chan as the monkey, of course. Love Jackie Chan. I wish his character had a little bit more, because monkeys, I mean, they're all hysterical characters. I really enjoy every single one. And then J.K. Simmons, who plays Kai, the main antagonist of this, I really liked Kai.
I thought that was just a really interesting interpretation for that kind of character where, I mean, he's just petty. He just wants to be remembered and acknowledged. And the fact that anytime that he's not acknowledged or remembered as like this great warrior that he feels that he is, he just gets really worked up about that.
Yeah. I love the way that they portrayed him too, because he is physically, he's a intimidating character, just visually as well. And because he has horns and he's green. Green is not the best color. Green's usually associated with, you know, being a villain, being evil, and, you know, green with envy. So I like visually how they portrayed him. And then, you know, with J.K. Simmons, there was that one scene where, you know, Kai comes back to the mortal world, and then he's, like, listing all his nicknames as, like, Jade Slayer. What was it? Jade Slayer?
Yeah.
Like, just one of them. So, like, trying to convince people that he's evil.
Yeah, exactly. And nobody's like,
I don't know you. So it's like, he is a villain, but no one knows him.
Yeah, and I mean, I know that this was another recast as well, along with Mei Mei, that Mads Mikkelsen was originally going to be doing Kai, but then they changed that around and brought in J.K. for that.
Well.
Yes. Because I know they did more rewriting on this character than probably any of the other characters. So just interesting to see the evolution of what was and what it came to be. And where it ended up with J.K. Simmons, I thought was a really interesting take with that kind of character.
Yeah, and I liked how it was, again, another spiritual being. And so, like, whatever skill set he has didn't really, you know, reflect in the mortal world, because he can do a lot more stuff that we wouldn't know of.
Yeah.
And they said for J.K. Simmons, they wanted a voice that was scary, but also vulnerable in a sense. What did they say? Quote, he's got, talking about J.K. Simmons, the directors, they say, quote, J.K. Simmons he's got such a great comedy sense, but he can also scare you.
And I thought that that worked out very well for this character, just in terms of what he wanted to accomplish, but then also just that Achilles heel of just feeling like he was just never, he doesn't get the props that he desperately wants. And when he's not getting them, it just like he just it just works him up.
Yeah, and I guess the animators had a hard time like just coming over with the overall look of Kai, because in a sense he does look like a Minotaur, mm-hmm. but then he also has horns, so he kind of looks like a bull. So they were trying to find that like equal balance between both, someone that's like again physically intimidating but yet not cartoonish.
And I thought it was just a really cool visual, just even from the beginning when he's showing up in the spirit realm, and just like the cool just jade daggers that he's got attached to chains. Just really cool interpretation. The animation for that was spectacular.
It was awesome. You know, let's talk about the production aspects of this film, because it had a $140 million budget. So, I mean, in DreamWorks, this is their third film. That's pretty big for animation. And before they started animating for this one, they took a 10-day the directors and the producers took a 10-day trip to, I'm sorry if I butcher this, Sichuan, China, where the filmmakers took what they saw in real-life pandas and then animated over, like, the movements of the pandas.
And yeah, like even them rolling down the hills and stuff like
that. Yeah, they're, like, just the physical movements of pandas. And they also, you know, studied the landscape that was there and the village that influenced the panda village.
I thought I always love to hear about animators when they do these kind of research trips, and then just seeing what they learn on them and how it's reflected in the final product. And it's when you hear stories about them spending time looking at pandas and seeing how the visuals and the landscape around them influence the film. That was really cool. It's one of those things that makes you want to go and go to those real life locations.
Yeah, they went to Shangri-La, which is one of the biggest. They have one of the biggest preserves for pandas, and they're actually pretty cut off from the rest of the world because, you know, the pandas, they, I'm not sure if they still are, but, you know, they are in a very rare species. I mean, we see pandas a lot, but, you know, we have to preserve the species. So, which is great because, you know, they did a lot of research on pandas. And in the film, they had over 30 different individual different panda looks. So that's, like, how much research they did on pandas, which was fun. I really enjoyed that, which kind of brings us into the animation aspect. They, for the production, they had, of course, DreamWorks. But they also partnered up with DreamWorks Oriental, yes. Which is in Shanghai, China. So we had two different big production companies working on this.
No, I thought that was cool. And as we talked about before, they just giving them that more of a sense of ownership in the film, in the Chinese marketplace, to have them being on there, giving them a bigger percentage of the profit, since they actually, it wasn't just an imported film. It was something that was like a co-production.
Yeah. And then for the Panda Village, again, for the animators, after going on this trip, they got a lot of concept art. And I was looking at the concept art. It's visually stunning. It's like, oh, my God, this could have been the movie, and I would have still watched it.
Yeah. Those are the best books to get anytime an animated film comes out. If you can just get, like, the concept books and all the making of those, some beautiful concept drawings and stuff for
fantastic.
Everything.
Fantastic.
And that was the other thing that I liked, that they were bringing on a co-director for this film, because the idea is they wanted to deepen their director's bench because they want to try to get these films out in a more timely fashion. Because, I mean, it's been 5 years since part two. I mean, the original came out in 2008. So it's been almost 8 years, and we're only on the third film. I mean, I feel like live action, you can be a little bit faster production schedule. That always seems to be the bad part about an animated series, animated franchise, is that it just takes a little longer to get these films done.
Yeah, and for the concept art, if you're watching on YouTube, you can check out our video for sure. We have a few photos of the concept art that was a part of this making of this film, which is, like, beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. It's just a testament to, like, such creative people who just have a talent. And so they said for the colors that for the Panda Village, they wanted the design to feel very Chinese, but look different from the Valley of Peace.
And I thought that was really, really well accomplished. I mean, you've already set it up that it's in this really kind of remote location and fooling your expectations when you're dealing with all this cold elements, rain, the snow and everything, climbing up the ice wall to get there. You're really kind of expecting one thing, and then you get something completely different once you walk inside.
Yeah, it's great you mentioned the snow because they said for the Panda Village, it's very stark white. So that means that the white that you see when it comes to the snow in Panda Village is never fully white. It's like a dirty type of white because it gives it the more organic, earthy feel to it compared to the white that you would see in the spiritual realm or something. So they had very stark colors in the Panda Village scenery, which is, I would have never thought of it. I was like, well, white is white.
Right.
But even that they made it a slightly different type of value of a white compared to a different location. It's just fantastic. Even those color design details.
Yeah, and it's one of those things like that you don't notice necessarily, that doesn't register consciously, at least for most people, while they're watching a film. But that, if it weren't there, may help kind of not sell the reality as well as you'd like, as well as you'd want. And so maybe you're not appreciating it as much as you would, and you wouldn't even really understand why. Like, why doesn't this look quite as right? But then just the simple thing of just turning up, changing the value of that white, of the snow, where that all of a sudden helps build, make it look more realistic.
Yeah. And for the concept art, and also just these, there was a lot of animation in this film, but there were some scenes where you could see it was only 2D hand-drawn, which was fantastic. And, you know, that is for matte paintings as well. So we had, like, a lot of matte painters on this film.
I've always thought that Kung Fu Panda has always done a great thing in all their films of taking at least some portions of it and doing it as a 2D style and telling it in that fashion. I thought it was a nice incorporation. Even the beginning of the film where they just do the Poe running up to get out of the DreamWorks logo. I thought that was really nice touch for that.
I loved it. It's like, even seeing something as great as him going up to the DreamWorks moon, and I was like already sucked in at that moment. Because if you remember in the first and second, there was always a moment, I believe in the second one, you see Shifu is the one on the moon. And so it was like, I love how they have creative openings and in a 2D style, because there was a sequence at the beginning of this film where it was 2D. You see a lot of 2D background, hand-drawn art that is in, I don't want to say dying, but we don't see it as often as we used to 20 years ago, and I miss it.
Certainly with more three-dimensional animation, there is a great stuff to be done. I mean, Pixar, DreamWorks doing some fantastic stuff, Illumination Entertainment, the things they're doing, but boy, just some nice hand-drawn animation. There's just something about that. It's just, ugh. I mean, at least Japanese anime, things like that are doing it. Mm-hmm. So there's still a place that you can search it out and find it, but I miss seeing it in more of American product as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know about you, but me personally, I don't watch anime. I know I'm Asian. I don't live up to that belief. But that's interesting because I forget that anime is usually 2D hand-drawn. But for cinematic storytelling and for kids' animation, I mean, this is also, adults can enjoy this film. But I do miss 2D, and I wish they bring a lot more of it back. And I think what they did great was they had the animation and the 2D, like, so well blended in this film that you couldn't even really notice.
Yeah, and I don't know if some people have said that the reason that 2D isn't as prevalent anymore is because it's not as successful. And I feel like that is the wrong way of approaching it, because I think you could take any of these films, like a Toy Story or anything like that, if the story is incredibly sound and well told, it doesn't matter if it's 2D or more 3D graphics for that. It's going to be a really successful film. It's the story that's the heart of it. And so I think Princess and the Frog was one of the last Disney 2D films. And it didn't do as well for
them. That wasn't that long ago. That was like, what, 2009?
Yeah, and it seemed to be that successful for them. And it's like, well, don't blame it on the medium. Just blame it on the story.
Yeah.
Maybe not have been as strong as it should have been.
But I wonder if they'll start bringing that back more so. I mean, the direction that the kids filmmaking films out there, it's mostly just going to be animation.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, which is a shame because it's such a fantastic form. And I guess that's a great thing about Blu-rays is that you're able to still go back in and show. So they're never going to be forgotten, but they're never going to get a chance to really go see them in the theater and see them in the big screen like the way.
So we need something after Princess and the Frog, another film. I may or may not have Princess and the Frog on my DVR. That's great. Or on DVD. I can't say it enough. I want to see more 2D. But the animation was fantastic. Trying to do the research, there wasn't, like, that much out there because there's already been, like, 1 and 2. We know, like, what went into that. And I felt like it was kind of, like, the same things. Like, they used the same methods. But, again, they had a... create a whole new world with the spiritual realm.
I thought that the spirit realm was really interesting, and just the way that when they start using their chi and it became almost like painterly brushstrokes in the sky and stuff like that in the spirit realm. I thought that was a really cool interpretation. And just to see the one thing that really was striking me visually about that in the spirit realm was just as rocks and things would be shattered, just the way just the little bits of debris as the rocks were shattering.
Just float away.
Oh, I thought just that was really just the nice attention to detail for that. I was really appreciating those shots.
Right. And just, you know, also the storyline with the spiritual realm and honing your chi as well. That, like, chi is a big Chinese cultural influence. And I liked how they brought that into the storyline because everyone could still understand what was going on. It's like finding the force that drives everything, the true nature of who you are, and, like, finding your chi and finding your inner peace. I thought that was really a nice aspect to watch. For kids and for adults.
Yeah, and I thought it really tracked well for Po's character, so that when he gets to that point where he knows that Kai's coming to the village and the pandas decide they're going to help him, that's when he finally realizes that, he understands now what Chifu was trying to get him to understand about you trying to make somebody the best possible version of themselves. And just as you see that training montage, and even Tigress doesn't understand what the heck's going on for that. Yes, but you just see him just almost karate kidding it like that with all the people in the Panda Village. Just whatever they're naturally great at, he just makes sure that they just become the best possible version of that. And then you see how it pays off in the big final fight scenes.
And I love that. That was so creative and a simple. I shouldn't say simple, but it was such a simple thought. You're like, why not do everything I do on a regular basis and just enhance it and actually put meaning to it and have a purpose for it?
Yeah, just like even the ribbon twirling with Mei Mei. And then just, all right, now we're going to give you some nunchucks.
Yeah.
Do the same thing you do with the ribbons, but now do it with the nunchuck.
Oh, which was great. And which added, because, you know, we see Mei Mei's character, she's using the ribbon twirling as, like, a way to get attention and whatnot. But it's also to knock people down at the end and, like, actually trip them up. So I really enjoyed, like, just the little aspects of here and there.
And I even just like the little moments for Tigress. I mean, she didn't have as much to do in this film. A little bit more than the rest.
A little bit
but,
more.
But just the even little subtle moments there with her kind of bonding with the young panda cub that was a big fan of hers. And just how she becomes a little bit more just maternal instincts kind of kicking a little bit. Very protective and using her in the fight scenes and stuff. But it was interesting to see just those little subtle moments that aren't addressed a lot and really aren't even mentioned at all in the course of the story. But if you're just watching in the background and you're seeing those little just interactions between the two characters, it at least gave that character a little bit of a forward movement.
Yeah. And I believe after the second film, there was an animation short going more in the backstory of Tigress and where she comes from, and then at the end of that, so it really just like builds her character up even a little bit more and why she is the way she is. And a lot of people from the reactions from that film, like a lot of people want Po and Tigress to be a couple. I was like, yeah, that's very relationship, you know, audience expectations of female and male. And would you like to see Tigress and Po together?
It's like, I don't know.
Would that add anything?
I don't know if it would add anything, but it's like, I guess you can't help but have an interesting female and male character that are sharing the screen time together, and there will be some percentage of that audience that will then want to ship them, as we say.
Ship them.
Yes, to see them in sort of, and they will just see those kind of connections, where it could be just incredibly close friends, but other people will interpret it as other more romantic intentions, and feel like, oh, they need to be a couple. Like, no, can they just be both really strong, capable people who just happen to be friends and not romantically involved?
Yeah. It's like they don't have to be together. And then another fun character that I don't think we mentioned was Po's real father, you know, the one who raised him.
Oh, James Hong, great.
Oh, yeah, James Hong, great actor. I love the character, especially in this. Now seeing another father figure imposed life. You could see the jealousy, but it was still handled in a very comedic way.
Yeah, and especially for the first two films, he was just that nice little flavor that you'd add to the story. Mm-hmm. But he got a lot of screen time in this one. It was really interesting. I was like, all right, Mr. Ping really got a lot of attention on this. Which, given the nature of the story, when you see somebody's anybody that has adopted a child, and they have that yearning to find out where they're really from, and or a parent, their real parent comes back into the picture. Where do you see yourself? I thought that was it gave his character a lot of great moments.
Yeah, and I think what they did great in the second film is that they did have a flashback moment of like his father or he finding Poe as a baby, and then you know taking him and feeding him, and then realizing all these times raising Poe, he's like, I'm pretty much your father, and so like really accepting the father figure role and Poe being his son, and then now seeing another father figure come into be like, Dad? He's like, no, I'm your dad. And so I loved how they took that moment where, like, in real life, that could be, like, an ugly, ugly situation. But, again, this is kids' movie that I like. They took that element and had his character shoved in the basket and, like, being a stowaway more so.
Well,
and really integrating himself into that storyline.
Yeah, and even the authors, the writers of the film were saying that it's, you know, certainly these films, they have a lot of, like, jokes and punchlines, things like that. But then if you have a scene where a goose is talking to a panda about a child that they're both are taking care of, and he's like, it gives us a chance to actually become like real writers. We're writing real emotional scenes there between a goose and a panda talking about how to best way to raise their son that they share in common.
Yeah, let's talk about like some of your favorite scenes of this film.
You know, it was just I was sucked in from the beginning.
Or did you have favorite moments?
For me, right from the beginning, just seeing the spirit realm was really cool. And just seeing, like, the evolution of where, I mean, because it's certainly in animated films, and we're already kind of dealing with anthropomorphized animals doing kung fu. So you're already checking, you're letting reality kind of extend one bit. But then to see it brought all over to the spirit realm, and just seeing all these epic fights happening on such a wider scale than we'd had a chance to really see before, I was just really taken in, like, all right, but they're really stepping up what they're trying to do here.
Absolutely. I think some of my favorite moments were going to the spiritual realm. I loved how visually it looked with the color. And then, you know, we see Oogway, you know, being his inner peaceful self. And I really liked how Oogway's character, you know, just went throughout the film. Like, that's where we started off with him. We kind of ended with him in a way. But, like, building the spiritual realm, like, the whole world that all laws of gravity go out the window, and then it's just, again, you say, like, suspend your disbelief, but none of that seemed to bother me, especially when Poe goes near the end, he has to go and skadoosh, you know, go into the spiritual realm to take out Kai. I thought that was such a brilliant concept, and we also see Poe's character development and him accepting himself is like, I am the Dragon Warrior. I thought it was visually, it was so beautiful to watch.
That part was fantastic. Well, even the scene where you see him just kind of getting to get the realization that, one, he's over his head. He's in over his head.
Mm-hmm.
Kai can't be beaten by his typical way that he's been beating all the bad guys before, which is doing his little skadoosh.
Skadoosh.
Yeah, it's not gonna work this time. But just seeing that way that he can turn the tables on it still, the way he takes him to the spirit realm, I thought that was a really nice... nice little twist on the story there.
Yeah, and also for the word skadoosh, that also translates to charge. So we're like, oh, okay. So, and again, that goes back to the animating both in Mandarin and English. They had the challenges of, for the beats, the physical beats of this movement on this syllable. So skadoosh was one of the moments where they're like, okay, what can we do? At this moment, like, the whole finger, you know, bending, skadoosh, something as simple as that, that they're like, okay, we have to think of a fun word.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
Yeah.
Another one I did enjoy is just, you see where Poe's dad takes it back in, shows him, like, that just the simple photo or drawing there of Poe and his mother, and just as he's thinking about that, and just at that moment where his father's breaking down, just about how he lost everything, and you can just kind of see that this character, as much as we've seen him kind of be happy-go-lucky at the beginning of the movie, I mean, he still carries just a lot of just sadness and regret about everything that's happened, the years that he's missed with his son, that his wife is gone. I feel like he's lost a lot.
Yeah, but he made up a lot, too. And I liked how Poe went from one family to another. And more so, like, just opening up his world and the people he interacts with. Because he, for the most part, the audience sees him. He starts off as a fairly lazy panda. But then he gets the discipline of kung fu and obedience that in everyday training and whatnot, he knows how to follow orders. And then to see him go back to a community where they're all, in a way, they're lazy. They're pandas. They don't really do much. Like, no, one of the first rules is to sleep longer.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's very panda-like. To see Poe go from, like, one character aspect to another, I thought was real fun to watch. And then to see him, like, go back to the disciplinarian, but use those lazy skills to something, put those to use. I thought that was a fun character choice and motivation.
Yeah, because it was without ever seeing any of the other pandas, you would just see Poe's actions from the first two films. It's like, oh, he's just being a panda.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden he's put into a world where, no, you're not the only panda. There's a bunch of other pandas, and there have been pandas all their lives, and they know they're pandas, and they're doing panda things, and you can't do those either. You're kind of a fish out of water on that side as well, even though it's something you may have always wanted to find your people, find others like you. You're still kind of a fish out of water because you don't know how to roll down a hill properly, things like that.
You don't know how to roll.
You're not eating to your full potential. Things like that.
I always knew I wasn't eating to my full potential. I loved how he said that line twice. He's like, yes. I knew it. So, like, really adds to just, like, him overeating. He's like, no, he's supposed to.
Yeah.
He's a panda.
Drop those chopsticks. That's why you have another hand. You've got two hands.
Right. And I loved how they established Poe's father when Lee comes into the picture. The first thing he's doing, he's literally having a competition of, like, how many he can eat. They're like, Poe, they're breaking your record. This random guy is breaking your record. But shows that, like, yeah, he gets it from somewhere. He gets it from his father. He gets it from his family.
Yeah.
And it was just so fun to watch, like, those little aspects and details from the first and second still being carried throughout through this one.
Yeah. And again, I know we talked about it just a little bit as we're talking about Mr. Ping, but just that scene where Ping and Lee are talking, and Ping comes to him and just says, like, no. I was worried about you coming into Poe's life, but I realized I know there's more for Poe. This is all about Poe, and now that he's got two fathers, which is great. So I thought that was just a nice little, very human moment right in there that I think a lot of people can apply to any of their situations. It was more than just in that moment, but just had a nice kind of worldwide kind of storytelling kind of touch.
Yeah, worldwide theme, and I think at the end of the day, it's all about family. And Poe with his friends that are his family, and then, like, the actual panda community that he now knows.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really fun. Let's get into the sound and music. We had Hans Zimmer, amazing composer.
Yes.
Coming back for more. What did you think of the music? Did you notice it at any certain points of the film that, like, really stood out to you?
It was a nice because it also kind of blended both the 2D and 3D animation too. It was like during the training montage, and I thought like the music really propelled that as well. But just seeing the storytelling techniques they used for that, just cutting between 2D, 3D, the music kind of going along the way that the editing choices that they were making, cutting along that, I thought that was a really nice constructed montage in there, and I thought the music helped really sell that.
Yeah, and also what I found interesting was that while they were, you know, filming or recording the music, that they actually brought in famous Asian musicians to record. We had some musicians would be the Chinese pianist Lang Lang and the Chinese cellist Jian Ming. I'm sorry if I'm butchering these. And Taiwanese pop singer Jay Chow, along with his appearance of Patrick Babraska, they sung. So they're like famous Asian musicians. Mm. We're also part of like the music as well. And I was watching back scene footage, and we saw them like on the mandolin and like all these Chinese instruments that they so easily woven into the scores, which was brilliant.
Oh, that's really nice. The even just like when he finally does learn to harness his chi. At the end, just the music that's playing for that. I mean, just everything worked for me at that point. I'm always, you know, you can always just, you know, as much as you feel like, you know, you get a little wet around the eyes, you know, just like all right, you know, finally.
I'm feeling something.
Yeah, feeling something. I mean, it definitely, I mean, just to see that Poe reaching his full potential right there in the moment. And the way that it all comes together visually, as we talked a little bit about before, just that is all just stunningly told, the way that he's kind of surrounded by himself, like it was almost his chi version of a dragon coming around him. But the music for all that as well, just really
fantastic.
Nicely done.
What I noticed is, and also, you know, doing research, Poe, his character has his own individual theme, and then for Hans Zimmer, he created a separate theme for Lee, the father. And then when it comes down to the whole spiritual realm scene and, you know, the whole pandas, they all get together and they help harness their chi to get Poe out of the spiritual realm. At that moment, that was the moment where Lee and Poe were working together, and both of their individual scores came together to create one big overall theme.
Oh, that's
brilliant. Yes. And that was what was played when the whole flower petals like circling around and raising up to the sky and the reveal of Poe coming back to the mortal world. I was like, brilliant.
Yes.
You would never think it.
No.
It's like, that was like, Hans Zimmer, you're a genius. That is why you're Academy Award winning. Also, John Powell, who actually collaborated with Hans Zimmer in the first two films, didn't return for the third one because he was working on Pan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, which, I mean, Pan, fun movie, but it was unfortunate that he wasn't part of this one.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, sometimes you want to stretch your wings, I guess.
And yeah. Like, well, but, you know, good for John Powell because he's well-established as well.
Yeah.
So let's get into the box office and reception. This film was released in 3,987 theaters. That's a lot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like it just really just shows you that. I mean, DreamWorks is invested in this as a franchise, and so they really want to. And I think it's easy to put that kind of push behind something that, I mean, it is a good story. I mean, you would think like, oh, it's the third, they're starting to kind of phone it in. No. I felt like this was just a really well-told story. So that type of box office or theater push is, I think, well-deserved.
And then I realized that, you know, one would think that's a big number because this film, Kung Fu Panda 3, was opened simultaneously in America and in China. So you had like double the amount of theaters. And what was interesting for the Chinese, as of right now, I believe the date I pulled this was February 4th, 2016, they actually made a record breaking $58 million in China. Where it was released but timed to the Chinese New Year.
No, I thought it was interesting because they originally this was supposed to be released in December of last year, but then they're worried about Force Awakens, so they pushed it off, and then it was going to be back in March of this year, and then they moved it up to now January 29th when it came out. And I feel like that ties in really well with the such Chinese market involvement right there. You tie again into the Lunar New Year and things like that.
Yeah, and so the opening domestic weekend, so here in United States, it garnered $46 to $47 million, and then foreign, it was $82 million. So, you know, together, Kung Fu Panda 3 has already topped $150 million.
I think,
holy crap, in its first week.
Yeah, and you, sadly, you know, just like I guess traditionally, you think like January is sort of like a dumping ground for films that the studio is not that jazzed about. But I think you're seeing that is definitely starting to change, like with the Fast and Furious franchise, some of the Marvel films, you know, Batman vs. Superman coming off in March. So you're seeing films, I'm getting less and less conditioned to not think of, like, if something's going to be released in January, it's a movie that the studio doesn't care about. Because,
right.
I mean, you see films like this, like, no, it's still a really quality product. And it shouldn't matter what time of year it's being released, as long as it's a well-done story.
And it has a wider demographic to it, too. And mm-hmm. the different cultures, and I think that adds to the storytelling, to the overall box office. Not that this movie is just for money, but that also is a key factor in why these films are so successful, because it caters to so many more people. And so, yeah, I believe the calculations, as of right now, it's like 128 mid, but like on gear to get like at least 150 million in the first week.
I think that's great. I think that's a real, even with this franchise, I mean, you're just telling a simple story, but in a very fantastical way. And mm-hmm. again, with this, it was just with Poe just trying to become, pushing himself out of his comfort zone and trying to become the best possible version of himself. I think that's really, so we talked about a very simple story, but you can then add all the great Kung Fu Panda trappings that we can add to that. And you put the two of those together and it becomes a really strong film.
I agree. Very, very strong film. Where would you rank this out of all the Kung Fu Panda movies, is this your favorite one? Is this your least favorite one? There's only been three.
I'd probably put the second.
Okay.
I mean, sadly, when I think about Kung Fu Panda, I mean, I love, just see animated fight scenes. They've always been my bread and butter.
Awesome.
Yes.
Right.
So, whether it be in this franchise or any film, I love to see fight scenes choreographed. And I felt like, with the villain that we had in the first film, just like the fight scenes in there were just so phenomenal. And I felt like this was a nice kind of coming way to go back around with that as well. I mean, Shen in the second film with all, the fireworks and the technology and stuff like that, a different kind of, approach to take with it. And you want to do something, you don't want to become formulaic in the types of villains that you're going to fight.
And I feel that caters, that type of technology storyline caters to the current demographic, and we're watching it back in 2011 because the second one was released in 2011. Technology is always advancing, and it's a big thing. So I think, in a way, unfortunately, that kind of makes them timely as well.
Mm-hmm.
Where I felt this one was less timely, it was more timeless.
Definitely, I feel like you could watch this anytime, and the themes that it have, like you're saying, they could have been from any time.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so what were your final thoughts of this film? Love it? Recommend it?
I would definitely recommend it. I mean, I know some people are thinking, Kung Fu Panda 3, and you hear that, and you're like, oh, boy. But no, I think these are really just simple kind of human stories, but told in a really fantastic, fun way. And it was interesting to hear that they see these as possibly a six-film kind of franchise, because I felt like where they take the character at the end of this one, has a nice sense of as resolution. So,
do you want to see six films?
I the only thing for me is if the intention for the six films was to kind of track the lifespan of Poe, so by the end he becomes almost like Oogway by the end of it, as he's passing the torch on to somebody else. That could be interesting if they went that route. I have no idea, but if it was kind of more just in the same kind of time, I don't know.
Okay.
I feel like where they brought him is I don't know what other story there might be to tell. It feels pretty complete.
Right, and we mentioned at the top of the show, does this, the way that they ended this film, it was very, you got your first, second, middle, and last act, and it had a full, complete story line, and I feel, do you think at the end of this film, it can garner another three films?
I would not think another three films. I think that would be
at least one more.
If you want to, I guess it all depends. If you can come up with just a simple story that touches on a lot of that everybody can relate to, that the very human element, that then I could see one more that kind of rounds out the Kung Fu Panda series.
Well, my thing is Poe has already mastered Kung Fu. He's the Dragon Warrior, and then he's the Master of Chi.
Yeah, he's mastered inner peace, mastered Chi.
Mastered inner peace, and now he's learned all these things. What else can he master? So what other cultural phenomena can he master?
Yeah, I would think the only other thing is if you bring in, possibly parenthood into the mix. I mean, for somebody that... So I would think that would possibly be another journey for somebody that has always been searching for family and what that meant and where he's really from, then all of a sudden now to trying to start a family of his own, and how does he impart those lessons?
You know what I'd be okay with? Maybe not a Kung Fu Panda, maybe Kung Fu Mantis, Kung Fu Tigress, or another strong story with the other characters that he fights with.
I would think, especially if you see something with Despicable Me, they did Minion Mayhem. I mean, you're able to take off those popular characters and spin them off in their own movie. And these characters are so great that haven't got as much story, love, and attention as that they're capable of having. It would be cool to see a spinoff with them.
Yeah. Kung Fu Shifu.
Oh, all right.
There you go. Yes. You already have the name set.
Archery Marks, you listening?
So, I love all the characters. And I wanted to see more of Crane and Viper and all of them and Monkey. All the characters are so interesting and funny to watch that I would love to see individual maybe shorts of them or another film that focuses just on them, because I feel like they didn't get enough time for us to love them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like the only ones that really got any more, Tigress a little bit, and then Shifu at least, because he kind of helps start Poe on his journey, and then just the person that's always he just wants to accomplish something and is always exasperated when somebody can just come along and accomplish it so much easier.
Yeah. So I would love spinoffs.
Yes, let's do some spinoffs.
Let's do some spinoffs. So while we spin off of this show, hey, where can everyone keep following you?
You can follow me on Twitter, guys, at HappyGoJackie. So, yeah, come and check me out. Let's talk about Kung Fu Panda 3.
There you go. And you can follow me on Twitter at SerafiniTV. You can follow all of us here at The Popcorn Talk on Twitter. Follow Anatomy of a Movie on Twitter at Movie Anatomy Kung Fu Panda 3. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Rate, comment, download, subscribe, iTunes, leave a review. Leave a review in the YouTube section. Let us know what your thoughts were of this fun film. We have way more movies to talk about in the future. Like, 2016 is just beginning. We have so many movies and more animations to come. I am sure of that. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next time.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.